This episode of BaragWorld.com is sponsored by Headscape.co.uk and Podvine.com.
Welcome to
BaragWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing and running websites.
This is what everybody waits for.
Hello and welcome to the spooky Halloween episode of BoagWorld.com, the podcast for all those involved in designing, developing and disemboweling websites. Except I don't know why I'm promoting Halloween, really.
No, it's all rubbish.
Made-up American celebration.
Yeah, it's a bit like... Well, it's my mother always says that Father's Day is one of those.
Yeah, made-up. Do you know there's Grandparents' Day now?
No, there isn't. I don't believe you.
They're just any excuse to sell us crap.
More cards. I've actually stopped buying cards now for only, you know, like very important people's birthdays and things like that.
Very important people, so like me.
Obviously, I don't even know when your birthday is, Paul. I do, actually. I think it's sometime in March, isn't it?
Very good. That's more than I know about when your birthday is.
So, Paul is 47 in March.
Hey, hang on a minute. Do you know, I'm just getting pinged by someone saying, why is there no podcast this week? Because I'm flipping recording it now. Leave me alone. Recording it now. Go away. There.
It's because Paul wanted to have a long weekend to put his feet up when the company's really busy, you know. That's why.
Okay.
That's about right, isn't it, Paul?
I'm not responding to that. So anyway, Halloween. It's not just that it's a ridiculous American celebration, because it's not just Americans, to be honest. We're just as bad, because we've got coming up the 5th of November, which is Bonfire Night. Right? Mm. And this strikes me as the weirdest celebration in the world ever, right? Bonfire Night. Because we're celebrating this guy, I don't know what it was, it was 16-something, right? Basically, this terrorist, right, that plants a load of explosives under the House of Parliament, right? And tries to blow up all of the MPs. You know, it's not very politically correct in this day and age to celebrate that. Are we actually celebrating the fact that he tried to do it, or the fact that he got caught?
No, we're celebrating the fact that he got caught, hung, drawn and quartered, and various bits of him were deposited around London, and that we're all such a macabre bunch.
So why do we burn him on a bonfire, then?
Because that's cool. Why else? Yeah, I have sympathy, actually. I even have sympathy for Halloween a bit, because everyone likes dressing up and scary stuff and things that go bang. So a chance for fireworks is kind of cool. But my joke later, actually, relates, which made me giggle, because it's a joke about a teenage daughter, and I have one of those. And she wants to go out trick-or-treating. And I said, you're not going out trick-or-treating, age 14. You'll scare old grannies. It's meant to be for little kiddies. Anyway, moan over.
Yes. Anyway, on this week's show... Wow, that was a really big tangent right at the beginning.
Proper rant.
On this week's show, we have... we're going to look at the issue of who owns the rights to your work. So when you produce designs and code and things like that, do you keep the ownership of it, or do your clients? We're also going to look at, should you enable comments on blogging? Is it worthwhile? We're going to discuss how to whether to implement or not to implement. So, in other words, when you build a website, out of all of the different techniques and technologies that exist, which ones do you actually implement on your site and which ones don't you? And then the final thing we're going to look at is we're going to try and just give you a little bit of an indication. If you're a geek, and go on, admit it, you are. If you're
a geek...
No,
I'm not.
Well, no, you're not. We all know you're not. But a lot of our listeners are geeks. And geeks are inherently nervous about marketing and suspicious of marketing. That, you know, that's kind of selling out to the corporate evil. So
I'm a guitar geek, though.
Well, that doesn't count.
No.
No.
But one day we'll do a podcast about guitar geekery.
Yeah, okay. Perhaps we ought to have a Christmas special.
Yeah, I might even play on it. There you go.
Yeah, you ought to play. You've never played on a podcast. I think that's a good idea. So anyway, we're going to look at geeks and marketing and stuff like that. So there you go. That's what we're going to cover this week, if we can manage to stay on topic.
Unlikely.
Very unlikely. But let's move on to the news anyway. Bugworld.com. So let's rattle through the news stories as fast as we possibly can to make up for the pointless waffle at the beginning. Eventually, this podcast will be all waffle and no content.
All 4 hours long.
Oh, and 4 hours, that's very true. Okay, the first news story for today is that Chris Wilson, who is the lead developer, king of the world when it comes to Internet Explorer, has announced that he believes there's going to be a much faster adoption of Internet Explorer 7 than was first anticipated. And he bases this on the fact that in the first 4 days of the release of Internet Explorer, they had 3 million downloads, and that this is higher than they predicted. And so it looks like Internet Explorer 6 will be disappearing off the radar a little bit faster than we'd first anticipated. Which
that's
I think is a good news for everybody, really.
Mm.
I don't
think i7 is now my default browser.
Ooh, it is.
Well, I thought
your
I ought
default,
to do it.
Your default browser.
My default browser, because I'm not a developer. I don't have to, you know, I haven't got loads of tools all over Firefox. So I thought, well, I'll do it and see how it goes, and it works perfectly well.
See, now I'm torn here, because I feel I ought to lampoon you and criticise you for not using Firefox.
No, not at all. But it makes sense for one of us to be
exactly
using that.
It is kind of our policy within Headscape that the developers and designers use Firefox as a default browser. Everybody else uses IE because it's a really good way of making sure that we pick up on any problems, because you and the project managers, etc., all look at the websites and go, oh, it doesn't work in Internet Explorer.
I had a problem with Firefox the other day, though.
Did you?
Yep, it wouldn't render. It was an earlier version, 1.0.7, and it just wasn't rendering something properly.
Ooh.
So there you go. And there was one really good thing about IE, and I'm sure you can set up Firefox to do this, but I never did. If you spawn a new window in Firefox, it goes back to your home page. If you spawn a new window in IE, it spawns the same one you were looking at, which is so, so much more useful. There you go.
Okay.
Am I bothered? Tip for the day. Yeah, obviously not very much.
No, not at all. Anyway, the next news story on my list is this whole thing about being a geek and marketing and stuff like that. I didn't explain it very well before because I got interrupted a lot by Marcus. But basically, there is an article that has got the longest URL in history ever. So I will post it in the show notes at boagworld.com /podcast, select episode 56. And it's a really good article if you are a bit kind of the geek persuasion, and you want a kind of bit of an introduction into marketing and why marketing matters. And it's just got like a few very simple, 10 very simple points about marketing, but it's written with geeks in mind, and it really is an excellent article and definitely worth reading. It's called Geek Marketing 101, and I will post the link so you can have a look at it. There isn't a lot more to say about it, but it was such a good article that I thought it was worth crowbarring somewhere into the show, and so I crowbarred it into the news, even though it's probably not really news. But anyway,
move on.
Google search. You can now add Google search to your site. Oh, yes, I know. You've been able to do that for ages. But this is something new. New and exciting. Ooh, I hear you cry. So there's been a while. There's been a few services knocking around that have enabled you basically to specify a list of websites that you wish to search, integrate a search box into your site, style the results page to display the results just for those websites that you've specified. Well, Google has come along, and as is Google's wont, have gone one better than that, and they've produced a really good search facility called Google Co-op. And basically it works something like this. You add a search box onto your website. You also create your own search results page. And that search results page can look however you want. And you just put in a bit of extra code so Google knows where to put its results. And then basically you can get Google to search any number of sites that you want. You can make it search purely the sites that you specify, or alternatively just give weighting to the websites you specify. So, for example, I could set up a search engine which only searched BOAG World, and it would only return results for BOAG World. Or I could set it up to return results from the whole of the internet, but give special weighting to BOAG World, so BOAG World would appear at the top of the results. Or I could choose to set it up to search BOAG World and Headscape, but no other sites, or any combination thereof, basically. So it's a really cheap and cheerful, cheap as in free, way of adding search functionality to your website quickly and easily. So it's definitely worth checking out Google Co-op and their new search facility. Again, I will provide a link for you in the show notes so you can get at that.
What's the down? I can't think of a downside to it.
The only downside I can think of is that although you can style the search results page any way you want, you don't have a huge amount of control over the styling of actually the results, if that makes sense. You do have some control, actually. Tell a lie. You can change colours and things like that.
And then saying people are so used to looking at Google search results pages that that's not really an issue either. Can it search PDFs? I presume it can.
Anything Google can search, it can search. So, yeah, PDFs. I guess
that'll do for every website ever, then, surely.
Yeah, well, no. Because Google it depends on how often Google spiders your site.
Yeah, that's true.
So if you've got topical content, it could be a while before it appears on Google.
That's the downside.
What else? I can't think of it too many, I have to say. It's pretty good.
Mm.
So there you go. I guess you don't get, they might provide this and I might not have spotted it, but you don't kind of get reports on the search terms people searched on and that kind of stuff.
Right.
Of course, you can choose to monetize or not monetize that as well. So you can show Google AdSense ads if you want to, or you can turn that off. So you're not forced with any of that stuff. So, yeah, very good. Very good indeed. The final little thing that I wanted to raise news-wise is a little debate that seems to be going on about whether or not you should enable comments on your blog. And it is quite an interesting discussion that seems to be happening, and it's all been kicked off, I think, by Jeremy Keith, who seems to be the first person to wade in on it. And he doesn't have comments turned on normally on his blog, although there are exceptions where he does. And he actually argues that comments are detrimental to a blog, and that actually they generally speaking, contain a lot of bitching and fighting and not much positive comments or contributions. Now, this has sparked up a little bit of a debate, and a number of people have waded in, one of which is Robert Nyman, who's said that basically if you don't have comments enabled on your blog, then it's not really a blog. And obviously this riled Jeremy Keith, who then responded. So there's a nice little debate going on about it, and it's an interesting subject, really. And I guess it kind of depends on what context you're using a blog in. But I have to say, personally, I think community aspects of a website are really important. They're a great way of generating repeat traffic. You build up a community of dedicated users that are kind of behind what you're doing and supportive of what you're doing. People get are pleased that they get to express their opinion and contribute to the discussion, and you get a collective wisdom instead of the wisdom of one individual. So from my point of view, it's a bit of a no-brainer to have kind of comments enabled, and obviously BOAG World and what we do here is very community-orientated. Mm. You know, we have forums, comments, you can send in questions that we use on the show and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, Paul will slag your comments off any time you like.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're rude about my posts, I will have a go at you. That's fine, that's cool. That's part of...
I haven't read what Jeremy Keith's saying, but I mean, it's his view. Well, it's my blog; I can do what the hell I like, kind of thing.
Well, yeah,
which is fair enough.
I mean, he obviously puts together a much more articulate argument than that, Marcus.
Yes. No, but that's the basic. A blog is a personal thing, and you know whether you want someone to comment on your post is up to you, the poster.
One would think so. Yes, I would agree with that. But he goes a bit further than that, and he does actually argue that he doesn't feel comments add anything to a blog, and that's where I would disagree with him.
Right.
But yeah, he can do what he wants. It's his flipping website. So there you go, that's the news for today. Let's move on. Bugblog.com. Okay, so let's move on to our main feature for today, which is the subject of whether to implement or not to implement. That is the question, whether it is nobler or no. It's a bit of a kind of nebulous title, and I bet a lot of people will see the title of this podcast and go, what's that about? I'm not downloading that. Well, thanks. So,
what's he on about?
What I'm basically getting at is the principle of there are so many different techniques and technologies around these days. How do you make the decision about whether or not you should be applying those to your own individual website? So I'm talking about everything from good practice like accessibility and usability and standards, right the way through to things like Ajax and Google mapping and APIs and web services and all that kind of stuff. So how do you decide what to apply or not? And this is turning into my little pet subject at the moment, and is something that I'm going to be ranting on about over the coming months. I've blogged on this a couple of times recently. This is the subject that I'm going to be talking about down in Taunton in a couple of days, and again when I go over to Florida the 14th or whenever it is I'm going over there, I can't remember.
Good to know the date of that one.
It would be quite easy.
The right plane.
Yeah, that would be good. And I think when I first started in web design back in 1993, don't you know?
Years ago.
Web design was so simple. It was such a lovely world of grey backgrounds and centred text and none of these pesky tables or, you know, anything. It was a pure and simple age where web design was nice and when there were no problems. But then along came tables, and then the browser wars, and then JavaScript and Flash and information architecture, and then blooming Jacob Nielsen stuck up his head and started talking about usability, and we all had to pay attention to that. And then after that, there was a whole phase of forums and community functionality, and then there was the portals. Do you remember the portals? We had the portals stage.
Yes.
That was
yes,
nice.
Yes, I do.
Then along came accessibility, and that was the next trend, and then CSS, and then web standards, and then there's Ajax, and microformats, and tagging, and the list kind of goes on and on and on. And so suddenly we're faced with loads of choices about how we approach a project. You know, from those early simple days where you whacked in an image and you whacked in some text and that was it, really, and you didn't have a lot more control over that, to now where there's this plethora of different techniques and technologies that we kind of need to consider and judge as to whether they are suitable for our site. But it's not even as black and white as that. We've also got to make decisions about how we, you know, not just how whether we implement a technology or an approach, but also there's kind of shades of grey in the mix as well. So take, for example, accessibility. You don't just have to make a decision about whether or not you make your site accessible. You've got to consider what level of accessibility you're going for. You know, with usability testing, how many rounds of usability testing do you need to do? How many users are you going to test? What are you going to test them with? You know, we also, even with technologies, we've got to make decisions about what's the best way of achieving something. You know, so a client wants a piece of functionality on their site. You know, should we be using Ajax or should we be using Flash? You know, how much Ajax do we use across the site? Is it really necessary to add Ajax into every single page, or do we just need to add it in core locations through the site? So many decisions, so many things that we need to consider. And how do we decide what to implement and what to leave out of our sites? Well, my feeling is that it's like three motivating factors, three things that kind of influence our decision-making process. And those are personal motivations, user-driven motivations, and business-driven motivations. So if we look at personal motivation first, let's be honest. What do you for?
I'm thinking that half of these things. Well, we're going to use Ajax on this site because I want to. The designer talking because I haven't done a site with Ajax on it yet. and yeah. things like that. But so, if nobody thought that, nothing would ever get, ever change, would it?
No, which is very true. But I do think a lot of the, a lot of time, and I don't think it's just designers and developers that are to blame here.
Yeah, it's clients as well.
Yeah, how many clients have we received, or how many briefs have we received from clients that are basically a massive big wish list of all kinds of bits of functionality that they think is cool? I guess it's the personal motivation is often, it's cool. This is cool and I want to use it.
Mm.
But that isn't bad in itself.
No, certainly not.
I mean, for a start, it keeps us learning. It keeps us motivating and it keeps us innovating on the websites that we work on.
But it can also help promote the brand of the client. If people are, if users are visiting that site and going, this site's cool because it's using that functionality, then that's something that's promoting their brand. So it's, you know, it's a win-win.
Yeah. But then what you're talking about there, you know, that's actually a business benefit, a business motivation.
Yes, it is.
You know,
but the benefit is that it's cool all round. Everyone thinks it's cool, and that rubs off.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, there's these. So you've got this personal motivation of what it is that you want to add to a site, what it is that excites you and encourages you, and there is a place for that. But the main thing these days that we try and focus on as web designers is we talk about user motivations. We talk about how a piece of functionality or a technique is going to benefit our end users. After all, we always talk about being user-centric designers.
Mm.
We're very much focused on helping a user to achieve their aims on the site. And this is a really good motivation and a good driver. And I think when you're considering all the different techniques and technologies out there, you do need to ask yourself, how is this going to benefit the user? What help is it going to provide to them? So that's user motivation. But the third one, and the one that I think is often overlooked, is business motivation. And I don't think that we focus enough on this as web designers. That we should be primarily focusing on how is this piece of technology or this technique going to actually benefit the business that we're working with. You know, will it reduce costs? Will it increase customer satisfaction and therefore repeat ordering and business and whatever? Will it increase profits? And what you just said earlier, Marcus, will it help improve brand identity and perception? Mm. Now, all three of these are excellent motivations. However, I think in a lot of cases, our order is wrong. I think a lot of the time, we think primarily about our personal motivation of, ooh, I haven't done any Ajax before, wouldn't it be cool to do that? Then we think maybe we kind of justify it mentally in our minds by going, oh yes, well, it have benefits to the user.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest, it happens. Even I, the perfect web designer.
Surely not.
Have before been guilty of this. Obviously a long time ago, when I was young and naive.
Young and stupid.
Yeah. But we do that. We kind of justify it.
Now
our
you're
minds.
Just old.
Yeah, I'm old and decrepit now. And to be honest, I think we hardly ever, or much more rarely, hardly ever is an exaggeration, but we much more rarely consider the business motivations. So it kind of goes personal motivation, user motivations, business motivations. And actually, I think, and this is a slightly controversial point of view, but I think you need to completely flip that on its head. And that actually the business motivations needs to be above and beyond anything else. And that everything else should hang off of that. So even when you start talking about user motivations or personal motivations, it should be in the context of the business motivations. So for example, when you say we want to make our site more accessible by complying to W3C guidelines, you know, level 2 or whatever, and we want to do that because that will help users achieve their goals on your website, then that in itself is not enough. Just say that. But if you say to help them achieve their goals on their website so that they feel a sense of satisfaction that helps brand identity, And enables them to make a purchase or to get to the piece of information you want to communicate to them. That is a business objective. Does that make sense, Marcus?
Absolutely, 100%. Yep.
Are you sure it makes sense? Because it just sounds like you're typing in the background and not actually listening to anything I'm saying.
I'm not typing. I'm doing some origami.
Oh, well, that's fine then. Carry on.
No, I'm listening intently. I kind of thought... I'm reading through and listening to this and thinking, well, I agree with him on pretty much every point here.
Oh, well, that's good. That's what I like to hear.
You know. So yes, I was playing with a bit of paper. I hope that made our listeners laugh. I expect it did.
You're just here to entertain. So I've thrown him now.
He doesn't know where he's at.
No, you've completely thrown me. So everything should hang off of business motivation. So even personal motivations. You know, it's cool to innovate and look for new technologies, but it needs to be within the context of business motivation and building the business and supporting the business that the website belongs to. So I think that's what we need to be striving all the time for is to focus on business motivations, and they often come at the bottom of the list and not at the top. So how do you do that in practice? Well, I think the key to success of this is to have clearly defined success criteria up front. Now, we've talked about... We've done success criteria before, haven't we, Marcus?
We have, yes.
So go and dig out the success criteria podcast if you haven't listened to it before. But basically, what we're talking about is a list of things of how you're going to judge whether this website is accessible. So, for example, we recently received a brief that had success criteria like they want to see a 25% increase in visitor numbers, I think it was, and I can't remember. There was a list of different criteria. Mm. So having that list up front kind of focuses your mind on what the website needs to achieve for the business, you know, why the website exists. So every new piece of technology or techniques that you consider can be measured against those success criteria. And you can say, well, if we go, let's pick an example. If we apply some Ajax to this site, how is that going to benefit our success criteria? Or even a better way of thinking of it is you start off by going, well, these are our success criteria. What techniques and technologies can we use to achieve those aims?
Yeah, I think it's worth saying that obviously success criteria sounds very businessy, sales site. You know, we're gonna sell more widgets if we're, you know, that's one of our success criteria. But obviously, this applies to all sites. If you're, you know, a site about, I don't know, getting more people to send in their poetry or something, there are still business criteria to that site. You want more people to do it. So probably if you could argue, well, hard to prove it, but you could argue that making the application form Ajax based is going to make more people use it, therefore it's a good thing to spend your money on.
Yeah, so that's precisely the kind of logic.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, Marcus has raised a good point here, which is it's quite hard sometimes to quantify these things. And you do need to kind of make some subjective judgments here. It's not all black and white. But just having a set of criteria and kind of measuring everything against that will kind of help to focus the mind on what the site really needs and what it doesn't. But we also need to consider not just, because you couldn't, I mean, there's a good example, which Marcus just gave. He gave an example where people fill in a form, and if it was an Ajax form, it'd be easier to fill in, okay? So more people will fill it and complete it. Now, yes, that will achieve the aim of getting more people to submit poetry. But actually, it might turn out, well, actually, an even more cost-effective way, rather than developing a load of clever Ajax-y stuff, you know, that does, you know, validation on the fly kind of thing. Instead of doing all that, if you just removed a couple of the annoying marketing questions, yeah, it would achieve the same thing.
Exactly.
So it's not just identifying whether something is going to help achieve a success criteria, it's identifying the most efficient way of doing that. Another example is if your objective is to increase sales by 25%, you could argue that making your site more accessible might help. Might help achieve that, and yeah, it probably would, because if the site is more accessible, more people will be able to use it, more people will be able to make a purchase. However, removing a barrier to entry, like demanding registration up front before you can see prices, will help even more. So it's context all the time. And considering what is most efficiently going to achieve what it is that you want to do. You also need to take into account things like the learning curve involved and the implementation time involved. So again, you know, that example Marcus gave about submitting forms. If you've never done any JavaScript before, then, you know, for the amount of investment of time for you to learn JavaScript and then to implement as, you know, a JavaScript client-side validation thing on the form will outweigh dramatically the return you'll get from it. So you also need to consider that as well. A really good example of that is micro formats that I've mentioned a few times before. You might look at micro formats and go, well, actually, the benefits aren't particularly high. There's not many search engines that make use of micro formats at the moment. There aren't many applications that make use of it. Why bother? Well, the reason to bother is that actually the amount of effort of applying micro formats to your site are so low that actually you might as well, because you'll get a better return. How do I describe this? Marcus, do you know what I'm saying here? No, you don't. Do you?
But, yeah, well, I'm getting the general gist of it. I don't know what actually implementing micro formats involves, but I think what you're saying, it's a very, very simple process.
Yeah. So even though you don't get a lot back from it, it's still worth doing because it's so simple to apply.
Some really whizzy piece of programming or something that you'd have to go out and spend a year learning.
Yeah. So, you might gain a lot more back from implementing an Ajax solution on your site or doing something very clever on your site. You might get a lot more back than you'll get back from micro formats, but the amount you've had to invest means, you're taking, it's the return on investment, so to speak, is not worth it. It's a bit like profit margins, right? You can sell Rolls Royces for a huge amount of money, but still, because of the cost of making that Rolls Royce, you make a tiny little profit on it. Or you could sell, sweets at 2 pence a throw, but actually they only cost a minute amount to produce. You actually make, proportionally per item, a higher profit on it. It's that kind of mentality.
There is another issue here, though. But to a website owner, they shouldn't be thinking, well, it doesn't matter. It's not their problem that it's going to take the developer a long time to learn something. That's the motivation for all developers around the world to be getting up to speed with these practices, because then they're more likely to be selected by a particular client.
But it's not just the learning curve, is it? It's the implementation time as well. And don't forget, a lot of people that listen to this show are web designers rather than website owners. And even those that are website owners may well have in-house teams that they use, and then they do need to care about learning curve time.
They do, yeah.
So we need to focus on return on investment, and just not look at how to crowbar the latest piece of technology or technique into our site. And there is a danger that we're becoming dogmatic about best practice. So every website we produce has to be accessible. Everyone has to be built with web standards. Everyone has to validate. And I thought I would leave our little discussion for today with a really controversial statement that hopefully is going to get a huge response and I'm going to get flamed. But I would argue that parts of the web design community become so dogmatic about this stuff that they need to apply it irrespective of the benefits that it brings to the business. But I would argue that best practice isn't always the best for business. And that's my controversial statement that I'm going to end on. Because you do have situations where what damage does it do to a website's profitability if it doesn't validate 100%?
Don't start talking about it now.
No.
What is next week's show supposed to be?
Oh, next week's show is on a completely different subject.
I can feel a response coming on.
You think I won't ever make it to next week's time? That I'll have to respond to the plethora of comments that I get telling me
quite
that I'm
possibly
wrong. Okay, we'll see. It's going to be the Flash debate all over again, isn't it?
Could
be. Anyway, so that wraps up that segment of the show. Let's move on.
Bugworld.com.
Okay, so let's take a quick look at the forum on the Bug World site, and specifically what people have been saying about this whole discussion of to implement or not to implement. Because what I do is I post next week's show as a thread on the forum so that people have got time to comment on it. And we've had one particularly good statement that I just wanted to include in the show because it's worthwhile. Marcus, do you want to read it?
Yeah. This is from a person called Blue Clock.
I don't think he's really called that.
You know it's a he?
No.
That's why I said person, see?
Yeah, how very gender-specific unspecific of you.
Anyway, this is what he/she says. I think you should always examine your own personal motivations for adding leading edge, I assume, technology features to a client's site. If the only thing that you can come up with is that it'd be cool to get to grips with that technology, then you may not be serving your client's best interests.
And the next paragraph.
Oh, you want me to read the next bit? Okay.
Yeah.
If you can come up with a technological solution that will save your client money in the long run, cut down the number of support calls they get, help them sell more widgets or whatever it is they try to do on a daily basis, then go for it. Which is kind of what we were saying, really.
Yes. But it's nice to hear other people saying it.
Yeah.
No, it's been a really good thread, and people have come up with some really good comments. And a lot of them I've kind of integrated back into what we've kind of I've actually said in the end. So it's really good. You post the subject on the forum,
and then they give you all the content for next week's show.
I know. It's wonderful. So basically, I'm nothing more than a speaking monkey now. That I just regurgitate.
What do you mean now?
All right. I just regurgitate what everybody else says. It's wonderful. There's been some interesting other discussions on the forum as well that's worth mentioning. The one that I particularly want to mention is the fact that everybody on the forum wanted to know where BOAG World listeners were around the world. So they've gone ahead and they've created a Frapper map, which you can get to at boagworld.com/map.html. And you can basically put your location on that map. It's really simple to do. Only takes you a couple of minutes. And you can see where all of the other BOAG World listeners are around the world. At the moment,
it didn't work for me.
It didn't work for you?
No, I thought it might be an IE7 thing, and then gave up and went on to do something else.
Oh, well, that shows a lack of commitment, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So please don't follow Marcus's example, and do take a minute just to pop along to boagworld.com/map.html and add your little pin in, because we've only got 88 pins at the moment, because it's only appeared on the forum. So we want to kind of really see where everybody is around the world so that we can arrange meetups and things like that. It'd be very exciting. Other discussions on the forum. There's a great thread about contextual advertisements. So that's where you go onto a website and there's some pesky link underlined, you know, an underlined link. And when you roll over, it's just an ad for somebody else. Have you come across those, Marcus?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of them?
They're annoying.
Yeah.
Don't like them.
I mean, I can kind of understand why advertisers consider them, but I actually tried implementing one very briefly on the forum just to try it out because we were discussing it. And the problem is that they look too much like links. So you just think they're links. It's very annoying.
Well, I went to a guitar tab site yesterday, which obviously not during working hours at all.
No.
And I had this ad that spread all the way across the page, and I had no choice but to click on it. And then it fired up some other window that obviously I then closed down. I thought, well, that's really, really, didn't like it at all. And it also added a virus to my machine.
Really?
Yeah.
Admit it. It wasn't a guitar website, was it?
It was a guitar website. Yes. It was. I was just after some guitar solo.
There you go. And so there's some interesting. I'm just moving on. I don't know where to go with that.
Yeah.
That's nice. I'm pleased.
Yeah, well, it was about contextual advertising, and it was just, you know, it covered the entire page.
That is pretty poor, isn't it? Really? Mm. So there's also interesting thread on IE7, unsurprisingly, and some discussions about the pros and cons of IE7. And there's also a really good post about know when a good business idea may not be good for your customers. And this is a really good example that somebody's posted. And he's posted about going to Amazon. And you know now with Amazon, they sell third parties. You know, third parties can sell via Amazon. Have you come across that?
Yes.
I'm glad it's now not just me, because whoever posted this forum, sorry, I can't remember your name, obviously has had a very similar experience to me, where he's accidentally bought stuff that he thought he was buying from Amazon, but actually ended up buying it from some third party instead. You see what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I've bought stuff that's, you know, through the Amazon site that isn't from them.
I know, but it's not clear that it's not from, or not particularly clear that it's not from them. Perhaps I'm just...
You get stung on the postage.
And that's usually exactly what he said. He ordered four items. He thought he was ordering all four items from Amazon. Mm. Only, in actual fact, one of them was from Amazon, and each one was from a different thing. So he got charged for postage on each individual item. Sucks. So
that does suck, yeah.
That was an interesting... So the forum's been quite interesting this week, but we need to move on to a question.
Bugrad.com.
Okay, we've been sent in a really interesting question by Ben. Unfortunately, it's a question that's been sent in to Marcus, which is not good. There's already been suggestions on the forum that we rename Boag World to Marcus Planet.
Well, yeah. Play the question.
Okay, here's the question anyway.
Hello, Marcus, President, CEO, and General Leader of Kickassery at Headscape Media. This is Ben calling from Detroit, Michigan. My question is this. How do I tactfully tell a client that they don't own the original artwork, such as the Photoshop and Flash files? I also really need a good way to explain to the customer that they don't own proprietary codes, such as custom Cold Fusion components. This question specifically refers to the client wanting to move their site off of my server and taking my precious code with them. I'd like to have a client know this from the time that they sign their contract, and I'd like a way to open a dialogue on how much more a site would cost if they wanted to own the code. Thank you. P.S. I really think it's time to rename the website lillingtonplanet.com. Long live breathe. Long live breathe.
Well, Lillington Planet. Quite like, actually, the best part of the whole of that question was General Leader of Kickassery.
What, you are?
I am the General Leader of Kickassery, I think was the way he pronounced it. President, CEO, all these things.
Right.
I really like you, Ben, a lot.
Right, okay.
You're
then.
A really good guy.
That could just let's clear something up. So I'm around next week. The week after, I'm off on this talk in Florida, by the way, while you stay here.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
If you're such a kickassery, or whatever the phrase is, you could do the show by yourself that week.
I could, but, you know.
You're a busy man.
I'm busy, and people might not ever want to hear from you ever again, Paul.
Yeah.
If
you
I might, did that.
You just upstaged me so thoroughly. Anyway, answer the man's question.
Yeah, we went through this, didn't we, Paul? Mm. Interesting. I mean, in answer to your main question, which is how do I bring it up with clients, what we did for a while was basically add a line in the pricing in our proposals for this is what it'll cost you to own this code. But very, very few clients were willing to pay it. And we actually felt that it was detrimental in the end to us winning business. And we decided to say, sod that, they get the lot. Which is obviously probably not what you wanted to hear.
But I think it's got to be that way.
It depends. If you do licensed products, then you can't. Then you own then it's your code, you own it.
I mean, that's slightly different.
At Headscape, we don't do that. If it's a technical thing, if it's a design thing, we do it on the basis of it's totally bespoke to you with every single project. So we can reuse stuff, but it's not going to be exactly the same. See the difference there? So if we developed something for client X a year ago, then there's no reason at all why we can't use the majority of that code, say, for client Y a year later. But it will be different. It will be bespoke to them, and that's this is the road we decided to take.
And how appealing has that been to clients? How many times
hugely
have we sat in meetings and we've talked about a content management system, and it's got to the question about, okay, so what's the licensing agreement? Well, there isn't one. It's entirely yours. You can choose to walk away with that piece of code, and you can go to another design agency. If you decide that you don't like us anymore, or if we spontaneously combust, or if Headscape goes under, or whatever else, you can take that code to another design house. It's all built using standard technologies. There's nothing very bespoke or not bespoke, nothing proprietary in there. And you can just carry on as if we never existed. And and that is just so reassuring to a client to be able to say that. And I think it's worth the sacrifice, Ben.
I mean, we put it into it's in our our contracts that basically at the point when the client has completely paid for everything, then it all belongs to them, including source graphics, source code, the lot. There are some minor. I mean, they can't resell it. That's one thing they can't do. That comes under our contract. So you do have to think about it a bit. Maybe this is something that we could talk about in sort of some more serious detail. We had we have talked about contract statement, the statement of work side of contracts quite a lot in the past, but we haven't gone into the really boring legalese side of it. But I imagine that could be useful to some of our listeners. Paul's fallen asleep just thinking about it. It's a tricky one. I would think that this could cause a few comments about, you know, we're selling out, etc. You know, if you create something that belongs to you, you create something, then it belongs to you. It's your you know, your property.
No, because we're being paid by somebody else to create it.
Yeah, I was going to go on to say something. We occasionally do audio work as well, as you know. I used to be a musician, and we've got a couple of other guys that also do music within Headscope. Now, the audio, I've got a lot. Obviously, I know a lot about copyright and audio. And even though we say in our contracts that this audio will belong to you, Mr. Client, it actually won't, because you cannot prize the ownership of, you know, song royalties, if you like, or the song ownership away from anyone, even if they sign it in blood that they will. So it's actually a little bit sort of up in the air whether we say that it belongs to our clients. We could probably go back to them and, you know, sort of 5 years
why
later
are
and
you
say,
saying
well,
this?
No, it doesn't.
Why are you saying this, Marcus? It's like you're saying that we lie in our contracts.
No, I'm not saying we lie. That's where we sit. But it's IPR is a really funny thing, because there are so many organisations in the world, and songs are a really, you know, music in general is a very powerful body, that they've basically made it very difficult to actually grant ownership of something to someone else. So all I'm saying is it's actually an arguable point, but our position at Headscape is that we pass it over.
Okay, yes.
I've been around that 14 times now, haven't I?
You have. So let's move on. Bugworld.com. So that about wraps up today's show. Now we finally managed to shut Marcus up. Just a quick thank you to our sponsors, specifically Podvine.com, which is the web design podcast network that we're a part of. If you're interested in sponsoring Boag World or any of the other shows, then pop along to Podvine.com. I will also say there's some exciting stuff going on with Podvine at the moment, but I cannot tell you because I would have to kill you. But you can expect some interesting things from them coming up soon. Other sponsor, obviously, is headscape.co.uk. So if you are interested in owning a content management system that is entirely yours, except unless Marcus changes his mind, then check out headscape.co.uk and you can see the range of different services that we offer. We do offer, obviously, a lot more than content management. Okay, so that about wraps it up. Marcus, would you like to share your joke?
Yeah, I've just changed my mind. I was going to do the teenage daughter one, but I've decided on another one. It's all from Ian. Ian is my joke fountain. Here's one. I like this. One night at the dinner table, the wife commented, "When we were first married, you took the small piece of steak and gave me the larger. Now you take the large one and leave me the smaller. You don't love me anymore." "Nonsense, darling," replied the husband. "You just cook better now."
That's a good response. I like that. But I think I can do better.
Go on then.
I'm going to do my own joke. Well, I say I'm going to do my own joke. That is a huge lie. I'm not going to do my own joke. I'm going to tell you, we were talking about Boag World merchandise, how we ought to share, sell T-shirts and that kind of stuff. And somebody came up with a really good thing to put on the front of a T-shirt. And this was Deadly Hi-Fi put this in. Now, you're really going to laugh at this. You're going to find this so funny, Marcus. I can guarantee it. Now, okay. Please, just if you're an American listener, I'm going to refer to hash, right? Hash in Britain is the same as the pound sign in America. Obviously, we don't talk about the pound sign because that's our monetary value. So, yes, this is Deadly Hi-Fi's idea of what he ought to have written across the front of a T-shirt. He says that we should have on the front of it, hash 000 is the new black. There you go. How funny is that?
I don't get it.
No, I didn't think you would. Hash 000 is the hexadecimal value for black.
Oh, I did know that, but it's six zeros, isn't it?
No, you can put three if you want.
Oh, right. That's it. Well, that's why I didn't understand it. And it's not the pound sign anyway, it's the little crisscross thing.
Yeah, hash. We call it hash, but in America they call it pound.
Do they?
Yeah.
God, you learn something new every day.
Have you never been in a situation where you're ringing some telephone system that's American and it says, press pound now, and you look at your phone looking for the pound sign, and it wasn't there. So, yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, that's why. I kind of ruined the joke a bit when you have to explain it beforehand, and also afterwards, because Marcus doesn't understand HTML.
But I did know that. Oh, I'm really annoyed I didn't get it. I did know that was the hexadecimal value.
So there you go. Anyway,
and all the F's is white, isn't it?
See? Yeah, see? That's very good. Well done. Anyway, in next week's show, we're going to look at building a community-focused website. We're going to look at the subject of forums, but not just forums, community as a whole and building up a community around your website. As always, we would love to hear from you, so you can send us an audio question or comment by going to odeo.com. That's odeo.com/sendmeamessage, one word, /Boag World. And don't forget to check out and contribute to the forum and the Frapper map at boagworld.com/map.html. Thanks for listening, and talk to you again next week. Bye.
Bye.